Welcome to the Reality Report. Michael, how are you doing? How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on the air.
Michael, there are a lot of threats to the Second Amendment these days, especially, you know, Obama's in office. We know that his administration is not very friendly. We know that that Rahm Emanuel has recently said, or at least on the campaign trail, said that anyone on the no-fly list should have their Second Amendment rights revoked. So, you know, in a time where freedom is threatened, the Second Amendment was placed into our Constitution for specific reasons. And I want to talk about that today, and I really want to lay a foundation for the Second Amendment and for its justification, because our founders put it there for a reason. And if you could, you know, help us lay this foundation as to why the founders put it in the Constitution, and then also why it's relevant today. And then we're going to get into the threats, the current threats, legislative threats, a little bit later. We're going to talk to some of our viewers, too, who are submitting questions at republicmagazine.com/webinar. And see what they think and get some of their feedback as well. So, Michael, help us build the foundation. Why is the Second Amendment important, and why was it put into the Constitution?
Well, the original copy of the Declaration of Independence spoke about life, liberty, and property. Pursuit of happiness was added later to include property and then abstract concepts like love. But life, liberty, and property are the three things that our government at any level, federal, state, county, city, is obligated to protect. That's why we invented governments. That's why governments are instituted among men. So the Second Amendment applies to all of those, and certainly the most important is life. I have a right to life. I have a right to protect my life. Everybody understands philosophically that if I am being attacked, somebody is choking me and trying to kill me, that I'm not obligated to just stand here and black out and allow them to kill me. You know, if they're trying to choke me, I can wiggle and squirm, poke their eyes, you know, hurt them as any way I can in effort to make them stop. Now, that is understood to be true for civilians, people who are dressed in normal clothes, but if someone in a uniform and a badge is choking you, does that change the answer? Are you obligated to stand there and wiggle and allow them to choke you because they happen to be a police officer or some government official? The answer is no, because government officials have no authority. They have no justifiable right to kill you. And so when anybody is trying to hurt you, you have a right to keep yourself alive. And in today's world, one of the most efficient ways to do that is with a firearm. So if you have a right to life, you by definition have a right to protect that life and a right to use a firearm to do so.
Now, you're going to say something?
I had originally started with life, liberty, and property. Firearms are also really good for protecting your liberty. If somebody is trying to stop you from doing something, you can use your firearm to, you know, defend your liberty. And if somebody is trying to take your property, a firearm works really well for defending that as well. And so,
how did the founding fathers use the Second Amendment to create this country?
One of the things that people forget is that the American Revolution was a separation from our original government. Prior to 1760, we were English. We were proud to be English. Hail to the king, and everything was, you know, wonderful. And over the course of the next 15 years, our perceptions changed. The king was raising our taxes and passing laws that we had no influence or input into, and eventually we decided that we needed to protect ourselves from the very government that was originally intended to protect us. A more modern example is Germany. You know, Germany had a government that was presumably intended to protect all of the people in Germany, and eventually people were elected into office who misinterpreted their role and their justification, and lots of people were killed in Germany and, you know, around the world. Russia is no better off. And all of these people were killed by their own government. So it's a sad and uncomfortable concept to deal with. It fortunately doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen often enough where it is a legitimate concern. And so people have a right to defend themselves against the local mugger, and also about an organized group of bandits posing as government.
Who do you say some of those bandits in government are today? Some of the biggest opponents to the Second Amendment?
Well, the biggest opponent to the Second Amendment is an organization called Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, also known as Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, also known as Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. They keep changing the acronym as if we're not going to know who they are. But they are, to the best of my knowledge, the only federal agency designed to eliminate one of the Bill of Rights. Their purpose in life is to, and they have a budget of somewhere very close to $1 billion a year, to put gun stores out of business. And if they close down all the gun stores because they make the regulations too dangerous and difficult to comply with, then there are no stores for normal people to go and buy guns. Now they're going to try to put the ammunition out of our normal price range and I would laugh if I didn't realize this was part of the legislation, to engrave a unique serial number on every bullet and every piece of brass, as if that's somehow going to solve a crime. Apparently, these people in the legislature have never seen a bullet that has impacted, a 2x4, a piece of steel. So,
well, that brings us into the Ammunition Accountability Act, which I do want to talk about as well. That for our viewers at home who are watching and who are listening at home, they have. And there's a bill that is currently at the state level that's being introduced. It looks like we have about 18 states who have independently introduced versions of this bill that will create micro-stamping on every single bullet. We actually did an expose on the bill itself, on the technology, ammunition, the micro-stamping as it's called, in the issue of Republic Magazine, issue 14. I mean, the technology is flawed, and it's just another way. I mean, they're going to be implementing a tax on every single bullet because of this bill, like a 5-cent tax per bullet. Michael, you know, they talk about, you know, we have the right to keep and bear arms, but what does that mean as far as the bullets? If they want to take the bullets away, then we are rendered incapable of bearing arms. Am I right?
Well, if you don't have bullets for your gun, the gun is pretty much useless, and it is up to each of us to defend all of our rights. You know, Gary, if I tell you to sit down and shut up and you are submissive enough to do that, having the First Amendment printed on paper really doesn't do you any good. You know, you have freedom of speech only if you are brave enough to exercise it. The same is true of any of our rights. Thomas Jefferson said that we only have the rights that we're willing to fight for, and people are constantly telling me that, you know, the government has this law or that law or some executive order has been, you know, written and signed. And, well, not long ago, the Supreme Court made a ruling in the Washington, D.C. case, and I had 12 people call me all excited that morning that Heller versus D.C. was, voted 5-4 in favor of individual rights. And I went, so? these people were stunned. They couldn't understand why I wasn't excited. And I said, well, do I need the Supreme Court to tell me if I have a right to life? Well, the answer is no. I don't need the Supreme Court to tell me that I have freedom of speech, and I don't need the Supreme Court to tell me that I have a right to protect my own life.
Right, so, because it's already built into the Constitution.
Yes, it is. To basically discuss it, Gary, it would be a little bit like you and I having a discussion, you know, to decide whether we are going to have forcible sex with some woman, and we, you know, agree, we vote, you know, 2-0 not to have sex with this girl. And should we have all sorts of people applauding our decision not to commit rape? You know, this is ridiculous. You know, it's not even, we shouldn't even be discussing it. The Supreme Court shouldn't even be hearing cases like this. It should be ingrained in every American that we have a right to life, we have a right to protect our lives, and we're not going to listen to 23,000 gun laws in the United States, all of which are unconstitutional.
Well, let's talk about the definition, to keep and to bear, and then arms. You know, keep, bear, and arms. Those are three definable terms that we place into our Constitution. Can you help me understand, help our viewers understand what it means to keep and what it means to bear, and what is the definition of arms?
Well, if I recall, the Latin homo sapien is translated into tool user. I may be wrong on that, but basically, you know, humans are, you know, really well known for using tools. And arms is a subset of tool which can be used for self-defense. That would fall, you know, a baseball bat could be used as arms. Now, the definition implied ballistic weapons. They had flintlocks during the American Revolution, or rather the British had flintlocks. Most of the Americans had flintlocks. That we had just invented rifles. The difference is that a flintlock has a smooth barrel and shoots a round ball of lead, which can curve in an unpredictable direction. A rifle has a little groove, a spiral groove inside the barrel. The projectile is typically a cone or a cylinder, and because of that groove, the bullet will spin, giving it greater accuracy. So very much like a football, when a quarterback throws the football, it is spinning and it gives it stability. So arms were generally implied to be some sort of a gunpowder ballistic weapon that would fire a projectile. But you know that.
So the definition of arms is the bullet, the gun, all encompassing devices that are required
to produce. It would also include knives or swords or cutting implements. Those are arms, like a bayonet on the, you know, the end of your rifle is part of the arms. It's used for self defense, usually in an aggressive manner, you know, but that's a hand to hand combat. You know, the difference is that when you're using a bayonet, you're actually looking at the person in the eyes when, you know, you skewer them, and most people don't have the, you know, the courage to do that. You've got to really be, you know, feel that your life is threatened to do it at close distance like that. The advantage to the pistols and rifles that we're talking about is that you can do it at a distance, and that it doesn't require a lot of strength. I always strongly recommend that women have pistols, or, you know, if they want to have rifles in the house, because, and this is not a sexist statement, it's just an observation that typically, on average, women are physically smaller than men. Men outweigh them. You know, they just, the testosterone, we can, in most cases, overpower them. And a pistol is a great way to level the playing field. You know, a woman with a gun can protect herself from lots and lots of would-be rapists.
So then, bearing arms then, what does this mean to bear? I mean, obviously it means, in my opinion, it means to carry with you around the clock if that's what you choose.
You know, anywhere within arm's reach, in your purse, you know, in a holster on your hip. I prefer a shoulder holster because it allows me to protect the gun. You know, if I have a holster on my hip, even with a thumb brake, you know, a strap that's supposed to keep the gun in the holster, if somebody comes up behind me and gets a hand on my pistol and I'm not paying attention, it's going to be hard to, you know, keep them from wrestling it away from me. But if the shoulder holster has the gun under my arm, I mean, they have to be in front. They have to be facing me in order to grab it. And all I have to do is just tension my bicep on it, and it's mine. I mean, there's no way that somebody's going to get a gun away from me. And this is one of the great fallacies. The anti-gun people love to tell you that most of the time, the bad guy will take the gun away from you and shoot you with your own gun. And I love when people tell me that, especially if I have my gun handy, because I'll wear my gun and say, okay, show me how that's going to work. They go, what do you mean? I said, I want you to take my gun away from me and point it at me. And it's like, well, no, I'm not going to do that. Why not? Well, because I could get hurt. Absolutely. All you have to do is imagine the hypothesis, and nobody's going to do it because the probability is the bad guy is going to have ventilation holes that he didn't have beforehand. So all of this propaganda, it is just fear-mongering by the anti-gun people to get you to voluntarily give up your gun.
Now, Michael, I got one more question for you before we jump to some of the questions from the viewers. This is regarding, because we're talking about the Second Amendment here today, and I want to talk about the well-regulated militia. And is the well-regulated militia the National Guard?
Absolutely not. That argument...
Now, there are advocates that all the militia became the National Guard and all this, and, you know, we don't need a militia because we've got the, you know, the National Guard.
It's nonsense. The militia is the people. And in fact, I don't remember where I saw the definition, but it was every male older than 16, you know, physically capable of carrying a gun, comma, except politicians. So politicians were explicitly limited out of that area of the militia. Why? Because the militia is that, you know, that body of people that would be called to defend the property. Most of us have heard the term Minuteman. Well, it wasn't a given person like Paul Revere or, you know, Patrick Henry. The Minuteman was a generalized concept. And if you look at the statue of the Minuteman, it's a farmer. He has a rifle in one hand and his hand on a plow, and it was we the people. And so the term Minuteman is derived from the fact that when you heard the alarm bell, you had 60 seconds to, you know, grab your gun, grab your hat, and form a line on the village green prepared to help protect the community. So we were our very own defense force, and every able-bodied man was expected to participate. So that is the purpose of a militia. And if we look at the Constitution, you'll find in Article 1, Section 8, Clauses, I think it's 15 and 16, that Congress has a responsibility for calling forth the militia. It also has the responsibility for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. If we, the people, are the militia, and government has responsibility for arming us, they should be handing out guns instead of passing 23,000 laws to violate our rights.
Wow. So Congress has the responsibility to arm the militia.
That's right. And we are the militia. They have a constitutional responsibility to make sure that we are equipped to defend ourselves.
I did not know that. That's an interesting fact. Michael, we're going to jump to some viewer questions in just a moment. We're going to go to a break first. And we're talking with Michael Bednarik, who is the former 2004 Libertarian presidential nominee. He is also a constitutional scholar. He travels the country teaching people about the Constitution. And he's also a columnist for Republic Magazine. You can see Michael's columns every month. We call it constitutional discipline. So we'll be right back in just a few minutes. And if you want to submit your questions for Michael, just go on over to republicmagazine.com/webinar. And that's actually republicmagazine.com/webinar. And we'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to the Reality Report. We're talking with Michael Bednarik, former Libertarian presidential nominee, a columnist for Republic Magazine. Michael, we're going to take some questions from our viewers right now, and the first one that comes up is from William in Leesville, South Carolina. William is asking about Obama making some statements recently to the foreign press that Americans will not have firearms by September 30th, 2009. Could this tie in with the front door satellite readings being taken all over the country by the new census takers?
It certainly could. I mean, I don't know why the census takers are getting GPS coordinates at your front door. I think this is an invasion of our property or of our privacy. There's no reason, no legitimate reason that I can think of for the government to have that. However, you know, if Barack Obama wants to become a totalitarian dictator and send out his goon squads to collect all the guns in the United States, he's declaring war on the American citizens. And I just strategically, I recommend that he not start that crap in Texas.
Well, Michael, there's also somebody, Kay in Los Angeles brings this up, and I'm excited to hear that Montana's pulled this off. There's a new law in Montana that states that any gun made in Montana does not come under the jurisdiction of the federal government. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm glad that Montana is willing to stand up for its rights. I don't know why it has taken us so long. I mean, the alcohol, tobacco, and the firearms really started as a small agency within the IRS and has now grown way out of proportion so that basically, like I said, they are explicitly and deliberately trying to put an end to the Second Amendment. And, you know, if they're doing that with the Second Amendment, and if they are successful with the Second Amendment, it's just a matter of time before the other nine disappear as well.
The BATF, What branch of government does it fall under? Is it just its own department like the FBI, CIA, or is it under one of those?
It is its own department, but the question was what branch. Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the Constitution refer to the legislative, executive, and judicial branches, respectively. The legislative branch, Congress, makes the law. The executive branch enforces the law. The President of the United States is the chief executive, and all the people working in the ATF and all these other agencies are technically executive branch members.
Okay, so BATF technically falls under the executive branch. Now, let's see. Richard in Pontiac, Michigan says, do you think that this will come down to house confiscations or voluntary compliance?
About as sure as I am that it's going to snow in the wintertime. Yeah, this is where we've been leading for the last almost 100 years, and it would be a huge surprise to me if they don't, you know, continue with this. They already were doing house-to-house confiscations in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. You know, they had it localized in one city, probably in areas of the city, but they were practicing. And I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're wearing a police uniform or a U.S. Army uniform. You have no authority to take my guns. You know, you've sworn an oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution, which means my life, my liberty, my property. And anybody who is trying to take my guns away from me is not only guilty of treason, they're trying to kill me, and I will respond accordingly to keep myself alive.
We have a question here from, let's see, where is it here? This is, it's related to a guest we're going to have later on in the week, Dr. Edwin Vieira. Caleb in Hot Springs is questioning, how does your view on the Second Amendment compare to Dr. Vieira's view? I don't know if you, what the difference is myself. But
I don't think that we have any philosophical difference. I think I may be less diplomatic in my answers. You know, Dr. Vieira would probably be really polite and say that they don't have the authority to do that. I'd say they're just downright guilty of treason and they ought to be put in prison. You know, if they live that long.
Rich in Tampa is asking, and this is in all caps, so I'm sure he's probably a little excited here. Do you think we are eventually headed for a military state of mind here in the United States?
We are already in a military state of mind here in the United States. We've got 20,000 U.S. troops that have just been deployed domestically. I think that was October 15th. Of last year, and it was announced on armytimes.gov, which is the official Army newspaper on the internet, and they indicated that, you know, the soldiers are coming here to help out, and one of their functions is to defend food caravans. Well, first question, what food caravans are you talking about? And the second question is, who are you defending these caravans from? If the economy crashes and food gets to be really scarce, they may be using these soldiers to make sure that people in Washington get food and people throughout the, you know, United States don't. And it's not the first time that food has been used as a weapon. Joseph Stalin killed 25 to 30,000 of his own Russian people primarily by starvation. After World War One, he demanded that all the farmers double their output. Whatever you were growing last year, now you got to grow twice as much of it, but you're not allowed to eat any of it. Russia was exporting all of that food to demonstrate how bountiful things were in Russia. The implication was, if we can give this much food away, if we can export this much food, you know, we must be just, you know, have all sorts of surpluses. And it wasn't true. The people growing the food starved to death.
You know, we've got another question here from Maritha in Paradise, and she's asking, how much do you think this flu pandemic scare was to help with the government's attempt to go into martial law?
100% of it. I mean, it's all a fraud. They're using scare tactics. They're closing schools for no apparent reason. And, you know, just because they're talking about it on television doesn't make this flu any more dangerous than before. They're just conditioning you. It's like poking at you. It may not hurt you, but it gets you, your nerves on edge. And all they're waiting for is something bad to happen, for somebody to you know, wig out and use a gun probably in another shopping mall. And, you know, all the soldiers will, you know, come rushing out of their hiding places to, you know, quote, reestablish law and order. Well, except that, you know, it may be order, but it's their version of law. And anytime somebody tells you that they are issuing martial law, they are also telling you that the Constitution is no more. It is suspended. It is non-existent. And the very same people who are claiming to have authority get their authority from the Constitution. And if you are telling me that there is no Constitution, you have no authority, and it's every man and woman for themselves.
This leads us to our next question by Charles in Antwerp. And he's asking, Michael, could we please discuss jurisdiction? Why is it that just because someone says they have jurisdiction over you, it is never challenged? Is there not an instrument that declares jurisdiction?
No, there isn't an instrument that declares jurisdiction. You know, basically, the government is doing the same thing that we should be doing. They walk in and they declare that they have jurisdiction. Well, because they're wearing a badge and a uniform, we acquiesce and go, well, they must know what they're doing. They're a police officer, they're you know, army officer, and, oh, my gosh, they've got a big, nasty, ugly gun. That's exactly what the Jews did. You know, we don't want to piss off the Germans. You know, they've got guns. We better go along to, you know, make everything smooth. Well, when they're telling you to get on the cattle cars and they're taking you out of town, where do you think you're going, on vacation? So we have to assert authority. We are the complete source of political power in the United States. The government works for us, and the phrase in the Declaration of Independence that reminds you is that we have a right to alter or abolish our government. So anytime we decide that they are no longer, you know, protecting our vested interests, as in life, liberty, and property, we have not only a right, but a duty, a moral obligation to change our government.
Here's a question from Isaac in Carbondale, Kansas. Isaac is asking, are concealed carry laws and open carry laws unconstitutional? Should we be required to pay the local government administrative fees for background checks, etc., in order to legally carry a gun?
Well, let me see if I can say this as tactfully as possible. 23,000 gun laws in the United States are unconstitutional. They don't apply to me. I'm not giving anybody a fee for them to give me permission to exercise my right. I mean, it's just not going to happen. I will never, ever ask for a concealed carry permit. If the government comes up and says, would you like a concealed carry permit? And you go, yes, absolutely, and you fill out the form, and for 10 or 20 years, they continue to send you a little, you know, card that you can hold in your wallet. And then 20 years later that you send in for your renewal, and they send you a letter announcing that, well, I'm sorry to tell you, we've decided to refuse your renewal. Are you in trouble at the end of this period when they refuse the renewal, or are you in trouble at the beginning of this period when you fell for the stupid idea that the government has the authority to give you permission to exercise a right?
You know, it frustrates me so much. I mean, just to hear that scenario play out, how do we undo this madness where the government is just declaring that they have some sort of authority to restrict what they don't have the power to restrict? I mean, it's like, do we pass law, like we just talked about earlier, do we pass laws to reinforce our Constitution when we already have something on the books that says that we have the right to do it? I mean, it's just completely ludicrous. Michael, what do we do here?
We already have a law to fix the problem. It's called the Constitution, and the Constitution puts limits on government power. But George Bush was correct. It is only a piece of paper.
Well, how do we get these people to stand up to their oaths? How do we get them to enforce the real Constitution and not these fraudulent laws?
That's a really excellent question. We can stand there and shake our fingers at them and go, don't do that or Mikey's going to spank you. You're going to get a spanking if you don't follow the Constitution. Well, even a two-year-old learns they can do anything they want because mama's never going to spank them. And so eventually, in order to fix this problem, we're going to have to do something a little bit more aggressive than just calling our senators, writing our representatives, and going out to the polling booth every November. We're going to have to indict these people. We're going to have a trial. And they can have any lawyers they want, but it's pretty clear if your name is on in favor of the Patriot Act, you violated the Constitution, you violated your oath, and, I mean, it doesn't matter to me, life in prison or, the hangman's noose. It really doesn't matter to me.
Well, I'm looking at, the Blair-Holt Firearms Act, House Resolution 45, introduced by Bobby Rush, requires a five-year licensing period for gun ownership. Currently has no co-sponsors, and they don't believe it's going to actually reach the floor for a vote, but it increases the power of the U.S. Attorney General over gun ownership. I mean, okay, Bobby Rush, here he is. He goes ahead and introduces a bill. This is a guy who's buddies with Obama up there in Chicago. I mean, what steps do we do to indict these people? I mean, these people like this guy here, Bobby Rush, needs to be indicted.
People. He needs to be indicted. Somebody write up a complaint, file it. But see, part of the problem is that the judicial system is also corrupt. So you're working in a statutory system where everything is based on the Uniform Code of the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code, and basically the government is in charge and we are merely peons. We have to stand up and assert our sovereignty and declare ourselves we the people, and it's going to be tough. The bad guys have been at it for a long time. We the people have been just crawling around and groveling for permission, and when we try, I mean, the bad guys are not going to give up their power willingly. They're not going to.
Here's a great question, Michael, from Janine in Missouri, and she says, can a militia legally come against a government security force such as Blackwater, which is a private corporation, private security, such as in like in Katrina or New Orleans? I mean, could a militia go up against these types of confiscation groups?
It happened. It happened April 19th, 1775. That's exactly what happened. The militia at Lexington and Concord went up against the, presumed de facto government. And whenever we have a 4th of July parade, we wave the flag back and forth and sing the Star Spangled Banner and all of our other patriotic tunes. I mean, what we are doing is celebrating the people at Lexington and Concord who killed the local police who were totally out of line. And so there's a philosophical question. Do we have a philosophical right to do that? Absolutely. The question, my friend, is whether Americans are going to find the intestinal fortitude to actually do it when it becomes necessary. And that's the bigger question. Not whether or not we can, but whether or not we will.
Well, what do you think? I mean, I think Americans are pretty much anesthetized through American Idol. They're bogged down with the bills, making that 40-hour week, chasing car payments. They're too distracted.
If things stay the same, I mean, the American people are beginning to wake up, just beginning. The tea parties that we had in over 1,000 cities across the nation with well over 1 million people attending nationwide, they are waking up. Now, they're not really sure what is wrong. They just know that something is wrong. They kind of smell, political smoke. They don't even know how long the fire has been burning. And so they are waking up and looking for some solutions. The government is aware of the fact that the people are waking up, and they are moving more and more quickly with all of this totalitarian legislation. And it even bothers me to call it legislation, because in my definition, legislation implies that it's valid.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to point out that Adolf Hitler never broke the law. He just wrote a law that allowed him to do all the terrible things that he did. You know, so if there's a book someplace that says it's okay to throw a subset of the population into the furnace, well, then you're not breaking the law, per se. And it didn't stop until, you know, the people finally, you know, cried out for help, and the United States came in, you know, as the defender to help out. Who's going to come to the United States' defense?
Well, right here, it looks like Gary in Mesquite is saying, he said, I'm mad as hell, and I've had enough, and we will fight. I think that's a noble statement, and I hope there are more people out there like Gary who are feeling that way. We've only got time for a few more questions, and we've got so many here. They're just stacking up. Lee in Tampa is asking, do you recommend buying a firearm right now? What do you think?
I've been recommending that people buy firearms a long time ago. If you don't have a gun, well, good luck. Yeah, do it yesterday. Do it right now. You know, don't even listen to the last 10 minutes of this program. Go out and get your gun because you're going to need it. You know, good luck getting ammunition. Ammunition has tripled in price if you can find it.
Mm-hmm. You know, that leads us, yeah, there's another question in here, too, about, you know, the ammunition being bought up. Someone mentioned they thought the Chinese were buying up ammunition. Another one says the UN will be taxing ammunition. Can you speak to any of those points?
Well, I don't know that China is buying it up. I do know that ever since the presidential election, gun sales have tripled. They have tripled. And more significant than that, the people who are buying guns are first-time buyers, little old ladies that, you know, typically bake cookies on the weekend, and they're going out to get themselves a pistol.
Why are they buying it? Why are they stepping in and these first-time buyers going to buy it? They feel there's a threat somewhere.
Yes, they feel there's a threat, and there is. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying that the sky is falling. You know, those are timbers. You know, the house.
I'm talking about the perceived threat from these new buyers. Is it Obama? Is it? I mean, they can feel all this. You know, like we just mentioned, legislation being introduced. Do you think that they're seeing that and they're running to the gun store because they're afraid, or is it? I mean, what combination of?
You know, it's different for each person. You'd have to, ask the person buying the gun. But overall, I would say that, you know, the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, the $1 trillion bailout last year, the double $1 trillion stimulus package, and the $3.5 trillion budget for next year, as if anything with 12 zeros left of the damn decimal place can be reasonably called a budget, you know, yes, people recognize that the economy is crashing. We are at 20% unemployment already. We're probably going to be at 33 or higher before the end of the year. You know, people don't have jobs. They don't have money. Food is going to be scarce. And, you know, there's going to be rioting in the streets. Look how quickly New Orleans went to the dogs. You actually had videotape of police officers pushing a basket through Walmart, pulling stuff off the shelves. Police officers who are supposed to be, you know, protecting private property, and
then you had the gun confiscation too.
Well, you know, the gun confiscation probably would have stopped if the confiscators ended up in a box. It's up to the American people. I know what I am going to do, but I'm only one guy. If I'm dead, liberty is no longer my problem. Don't go, you know, walking the fence at the concentration camp looking for me. Don't go around asking people inside the concentration camp if they have seen me, because I didn't make it. I'm not going. Now, what everybody else does is completely up to them.
Michael, we got time for one more question. It's coming from John in San Diego. Joe in Atlanta is asking. He says, what you been doing with yourself, Michael? Are you going to start up another radio show? He says he misses hearing your words of wisdom.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm not likely to start a radio program in the near future. I've been devoting all my time to Continental Congress 2009. The website is WeThePeopleCongress.org. WeThePeopleCongress.org. You can learn about it, and you can pick your state. There's a little pull-down window there, and you can find out who the coordinator is in your state, or you can go to the Texas state page and send me an email if you've got questions.
Well, Michael, thank you for joining us on this edition of the Reality Report. We hope to have you back soon.
I hope I haven't straddled the fence for anybody.
All right, Michael, thank you. Okay, well, that was a wrap. Michael, you happen to still be there, or did you hang up?
I'm here.
All right. We had to put in a cut point there. George, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right. You want to jump in here? You got any questions?
Actually, I was going to ask Michael. Michael, do you have a few more minutes? Can you stay on with us for a little longer?
Yeah, I can.
The reason why I'm saying that is I've been moderating some of the questions that have been coming through, and there's some really good ones that have come through for people, especially when they're talking about the sheriff's rights and other things like that that I think that they would like to get your feedback on. Gary, do you mind if we continue on?
Go for it, man. Go for it. If you want to take it over, I got to talk to my editor in the production room, but I'll be here.
Okay, excellent. Well, let me jump over here real quick and get some of these questions because I want to make sure that a lot of these things get asked. Jim in Littleton asks that many Americans have been convicted or convinced that the guns are the root of all evil, and their attitudes make them unwilling accomplices to the globalist attempt. How do we overcome the obstacle that people just think that guns are the worst thing ever?
Let them spend a couple weeks in a concentration camp. When the good, benevolent government comes and arrests them and takes them off in a bus and puts them in a detention center, you know, walking on the inside of the barbed wire fence will go, oh, man, I wish I had a gun. Of course, it'll be too late. You know, it's like getting out of an airplane and halfway down, you go, oh, man, I should have worn a parachute. Well, yeah, you really should have, but it's too late to go back and make that decision now.
Now, if someone decides not to go and get a concealed carry permit, but they get stopped for any kind of violation and they happen to have, you know, their firearm on them, and they get it either taken away or arrested, is there any restitution for those people to get out of so-called trouble that they're in?
No. We live in a totalitarian dictatorship, and if you let the police officer take your gun away from you, you didn't practice enough. You know, if a police officer says, Mr. Badnarik, I'd like you to hand me your pistol, I would go, certainly, officer, as soon as you hand me yours. Now, I'm fairly certain the officer is not going to do that. And I said, well, could you please tell me what excuse you're using to not give me your pistol? Because I want to turn around and use that same excuse for you. I'm not giving up my pistol. No way, no how. I've drawn my line in the sand.
And the only way to defend that actual right is to just stand your ground?
Well, yeah. How else are you going to do it? A piece of paper is just a piece of paper. You're going to give them your gun and then try to get it back through court procedure? How would that work for a woman trying to protect her honor? Well, I'm going to rape you now, and then you can go and file a complaint later? I mean, did that make any sense?
Here's another question from Jim. Jim's asking about explosive RPGs, other things like that. Would they be also considered protected by the Second Amendment?
Well, this is a dangerous question. Usually the question is, does the Second Amendment allow you to have a nuclear warhead? Or my favorite was, you know, does the Second Amendment allow you to have an F-16? And my question to that person was, do you have a problem with F-16s in your neighborhood? If you say that the Second Amendment does let you have a nuclear warhead, you're obviously a wacko and nobody has to listen to you anymore. If you say the Second Amendment doesn't allow you to have a nuclear warhead, well, then you've just conceded that the government can put limitations on your rights, and now we just have to decide whether Saturday Night Special, you know, assault rifle and cop killer bullets fall under that limitation. So the answer, let me give you by example. I have a right to keep and bear arms. I have a right to have a gun in the holster. I have a right to pull the gun out of the holster. But I do not, I repeat, I do not have the right to point my gun at somebody, because the time between my pulling the trigger and the time that they are done damage, there's no opportunity to defend yourself. You can't throw up a shield, you know, in time. So if anybody points a gun at you, they pose a clear and present danger. And if you're smart and, you know, well-practiced, you will pull your gun out and shoot them first.
You know, would that also apply to law enforcement?
Anybody who is trying to take my life, I take a dim view of that. You know, if law enforcement wants to surround me to take my guns, well, you know, they ultimately will be successful in getting the gun. But they're never going to convince me to volunteer. They have no authority to do that. If I'm surrounded, I'm in the car with a lady friend, and I'm surrounded by police officers who are intent on raping her, do I allow that to happen because I'm outnumbered? It's all a matter, I mean, we can talk philosophy all day long. We can talk about what you have a right to do. That's meaningless. It's just intellectual discourse. What really matters is what you are willing to do. I said earlier in the program that Thomas Jefferson pointed out you only have the rights that you are willing to fight for. I have freedom of speech because I've never met anybody yet big enough to shut me up. I don't have freedom of speech because the government grants me that right. And I have a right to keep and bear arms. I don't need the Supreme Court to tell me that. And I have the courage and the willingness to defend my life, you know, from anybody trying to violate my life. And it doesn't matter to me what color they are, what language they speak, or what silly costume they happen to be wearing. If they're wearing a police uniform or an army uniform and they are trying to kill me, I will kill them first, because they are outside the law, making them outlaws. And I will argue that they are also impersonating an officer. So we can go dancing around this issue. It's going to be a different answer for each person. Every person has to decide whether their life is important enough to actually execute self-defense. And it boggles my mind. I cannot wrap my brain around it. But some people will allow someone else to kill them because they don't want to use force. Well, okay, that sounds like, you know, in the survival of the fittest, you didn't survive. Now, I'm going to die eventually, but I'm not going to live as a slave, and I am never, ever going to give up my guns to any state or federal authority, period. They don't have that authority. The only thing that they have is the appearance of legitimacy, and, you know, they outnumber me. So if the government comes to get my guns, you know, I recommend that you're not the first person through the door.
Doug in Tulsa is actually asking a very good question that ties in with what you're talking about right now. He says, it seems as if the federal government violates the 10th Amendment all the time. Isn't there a strict limit on what laws the feds can force on the states?
Yes, but you have to have a state legislature with a... intestinal fortitude to defend their legislative authority. And I just want to interject that although if I was asked, I would identify myself as a states' rights person. However, that's an oxymoron. No government agency at any level has rights. They only have privileges. So when I talk about states' rights, what I'm saying are that state government privileges supersede federal government privileges. The only people, the only place you're going to find rights is with the individual. Individual rights are the only kind of rights that exist, and we, the people, collectively give the government privileges, as demonstrated by Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 of the Constitution, which says all legislative powers herein granted. Granted is the important word. We are granting them legislative powers, meaning that they are privileges, meaning that we can take those privileges away from the government anytime we have the cojones to do that.
Now, with the federal government, what the original purpose of having a federal government, what were the duties of that federal government to the people?
They were supposed to have all of the things that would be inefficient for each state to do alone. It would be inefficient for each state to raise an army and have 50 different armies. If we're going to be in this union, it was just a matter of scale. It's like going to the co-op. You know, I want, you know, a dozen oranges. You want two dozen oranges. We get all of our friends, and so we put this co-op together, and we buy a truckload of oranges, and because we can buy it at a truckload, we can get them at a discount price. So now you and I and everybody else in our little co-op will enjoy the benefit of reduced prices because we work together. The same economy of scale works for an army. It would be too expensive for each state to have its very own army, although we do have a National Guard for each state. But ultimately, the federal army was supposed to be there to have one army to protect 50 states. So that was, those are the type of things the federal government was supposed to do. They're listed in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution for anybody, you know, literate enough to read them. Certainly Congress hasn't.
Now, you talked about state versus federal. We've been talking about these different powers. The powers of the sheriff. Could you talk about the powers of the local sheriff as they relate to the state, county, and also federal governments?
The county sheriff is the highest constitutional authority. It's an executive authority within the county. The way that our system is set up, the closer your government is, the more power it has. So your city and county governments are right there with the people. The federal government is so far away, way over there in Washington, D.C., that we put greater restrictions on them and fewer legislative powers because people don't have time to keep an eye on their federal government. So the closer you are to the government, the more direct control you have on it, and the county sheriff is a duly elected constitutional authority. The job description of the county sheriff is explicitly to defend the Constitution and everybody's life, liberty, and property within the county. That's his or her job. And so the important thing here, we were talking about the 10th Amendment, the county sheriff has the legal, legitimate, jurisdictional authority to throw the federal government out of the county. And it's been done. The sheriff up in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, did that, but only after Randy Weaver's wife and son were killed. The sheriff in Waco could have and should have, but didn't. And there is a plan. Many of your listeners are probably familiar with the Free State Project, where they have a Free County Project. They've done some research. They found a county, ironically, here in Texas, and they have invited me to be the sheriff of this county, primarily because of my willingness. If we get enough people to move there and I win the election and become the sheriff, I have the knowledge and the courage to announce. I would write a letter to the President of the United States and the Department of Homeland Security and every other alphabet federal agency I could think of, and I would send them a formal letter, letting them know very politely that the county sheriff is the highest constitutional authority and that they are not welcome in my county without a written invitation.
It sounds like to me that the solution to a lot of our problems are to get the right people in place, actually know the Constitution and know the powers that be into these sheriff positions.
Well,
it sounds like that could be a really, really great fix. Instead of trying to fix all these in Washington with all these legislatures, if that's the highest authority, on a local government level, it sounds like that, if we can just focus on that issue, that would be could be a solution to a lot of these problems.
If you do a search for Sheriff Richard Mack, he has a website. He was a sheriff in Arizona. He took the Brady Bill all the way to the Supreme Court and won, but he has several books out. He does a tour through the country talking to the local police officers and local sheriff's deputies, explaining all this information to them, based on the fact that he was a law enforcement officer, that the information has more credibility coming from him. But if you talk to Sheriff Mack, he can, basically come out to your local community and make these presentations for you fairly easily.
Now, we touched on this very briefly. What authority, who has the authority to actually charge these politicians we've been talking about to bring the bills to Congress, the ones that actually vote on the ones that are they're unconstitutional? Who has the authority to actually charge these politicians with treason? How do we do it?
Any John Smith or Jane Smith walking up and down the sidewalk with a little bit of knowledge and a whole lot of courage can do it. But again, you have to understand the jurisdiction. If you don't know what you're doing, you're going to be walking into a statutory jurisdiction, and they're basically to put your paperwork through the shredder. And so what you need to do is you need to establish a common law jurisdiction, and it probably helped to have a large group of people go in there with you.
Right. There was a I hear a little noise there on the phone. There was a comment, actually, that I want to read out here. It's not necessarily a question, but maybe person that's asking this is looking for a little feedback, that we the people, should insist that all of our representatives vote in every bill that comes out. And if there's a way of holding those people accountable, if they do, they decide to abstain from a vote, or what your thoughts are would be on that.
Well, again, we can talk philosophy all we want. You can come up with a great idea and submit it as a question. Let's see you get out of the house and go and do it. Let me know how well that works for you. We've got to get people working together. In 1913, they created the Federal Reserve Act, which is completely, totally, unquestionably unconstitutional. And, our grandparents and great-grandparents did nothing. And then in 1933, FDR passed House Joint Resolution 192, making it illegal to own gold. I don't even know how to respond to that. And before you're really done being stunned, there were people in the United States who turned in their gold because the government said so. It's like, send us your daughters, too. The pure virginal ones, because we've got some project that we need. Are you going to pack your daughter's suitcase? I mean, wake up! How much of this government BS are you finally going to take before you stand up and understand your rights? If you don't know your rights, you have no chance whatsoever of defending them. And so
I've got two more questions for you.
Okay.
After this one. Woody and Ventura is asking, wouldn't it serve us to tell or explain to the inhabitants the absolute definition of sovereign, if you can talk about what it means to be sovereign?
Well, I could go into some, you know, political definitions, but the easiest definition is, because I'm the mommy, that's why. You know, mama is sovereign. She doesn't have a, you know, mother's hotline that she calls to determine what today's bedtime is. Mama tells you that you're going to bed at 8 o'clock, you're going to bed at 8 o'clock. End of story. Because I'm the mommy, that's why. That is sovereign. We, the people in the United States, are sovereign. We are the absolute total source of all political power in the United States. Well, at least philosophically, you know, because at one time we were willing to enforce that law. Lexington and Concord, we were willing to enforce our gun rights. Since then, the American people have gotten lazy. They've gotten scared. They're staying home from school because the, you know, mainstream media is telling us that we've got swine flu. Well, the Constitution is just a piece of paper. It's not going to make you safe. The only thing that's going to make you safe is being willing to stand up and defend your rights. You've got to know your rights. You've got to be willing to, you know, apply whatever force is necessary. And, again, it's up to each individual to, you know, decide whether or not, you know, there is a clear and present danger. And I understand that most people would not use violence towards a police authority at all under any circumstances. You know, they've got a badge and a uniform. They must be right. And those are the people that are going to end up in the concentration camps following the rules. Well, I don't follow the rules. I do what is right and wrong. And the government is wrong, and it's up to me and people who think like I do to put the government back in its place by whatever means is necessary. Now, if you can get them on the phone and convince them politely to, you know, just like step down out of office so that we can get somebody who understands the Constitution in Congress, then, you know, you're a better man than I. You know, do it. I'd like to do this peacefully. But if you go to libertystickers.org, you can find a web bumper sticker with my quote, "If the First Amendment doesn't work, the Second Amendment will." And the only reason that people are talking about all this stuff now is because they recognize the Second Amendment might be necessary, so all of a sudden it's becoming really important to everybody. Well, when do we ought to talk about this? Well, okay, talk. But the government's not going to listen.
Mm-hmm. Talk's cheap. That's a great segue into our last question for the day. And obviously, since we're talking about ammunition, accountability, gun, you know, all these things that take away, you know, the rights that we should be asserting, those folks that are enforcing the changes that are going to be taking place or that are going to be attempted upon the American people are going to be the Americans and also the police. Ben in Indianapolis is asking us, how can we unbrainwash the American soldiers and the police on this matter?
That's a good question. I teach an eight-hour class on the Constitution. It's available on the Internet for free in it was originally 7 one-hour videos. They've got it on YouTube and Google broken up into, I think it was as many as 42 10-minute segments. But it's available for free. You know, watch the video. Most people won't spend the 7 hours, but those that do usually call me on the phone telling me, gosh, how wonderful it was. You know, get your favorite military people to watch that video. Talk to them. The good news really is that the people who are in the military, by and large, really do take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. I mean, they're lining up, they're standing at attention, you know, they're being good little soldiers, but, you know, my evaluation is that 80% of them are on our side, and that when things get really bad, that, you know, the military is going to be defending us, not attacking us. But there is that 20%, and the government knows which 20% that is. Those are the ones that are going to be doing door-to-door gun confiscation.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to make a call to action for everybody out there that's listening, whether you're listening to the live webcast or recording, you know, of this, or even listening to the Reality Report, although they're going to miss this one on the YouTube segment. As we're talking about, there's a lot of people that need to be woken up about this issue, and there's only a few different ways you can do it. You can have a personal conversation with somebody, try to educate them, but most times the messenger gets in the way of the message. Like Michael was talking about, you can send them to video pages, you can send them videos, you can maybe even buy a course like the Constitution course and give books. There's another way too, and that's the reason why we actually are creating this type of educational resource, whether it be a live event or some of the other things we do in conjunction with Restore the Republic. We put out a magazine specifically on this subject, trying to educate people. While it requires a second thing for someone to do, a second step, where someone would have to take and go to a website and then push play and be able to sit there and watch the video, which is not a bad thing to do because we should try everything. Sometimes it gets through to people more in video than it does in other areas. There's two things you can do right now to get active with this. You can go to republicmagazine.com immediately, or if you're listening to the webinar, you can click on the little magazine cover. The Don't Tread on Me issue. You can purchase those magazines for $1 a piece. We literally don't make anything on these things. We need to get them out to people as much as possible and get this information spread. If you're looking for a great groundbreaker, if just like recently I was in the car dealership, I get an oil change. First thing I did was I take my magazines and I went off copy right there on the pile of all the other magazines. Put them in those kind of high traffic areas where people can pick the stuff up and read it. If you can afford, say times are tough because they are tough, if you can't afford to get magazines to pass out and do that duty for people, there's a different thing you can do. If you go to the magazine website, republicmagazine.com, you can sign up for our free digital subscription. You'll get a copy every single month, and also you'll get every copy we've done in the past immediately of all the digital copies of Republic Magazine, including the Don't Tread on Me issue. I recommend that you immediately send this to all your legislatures, your sheriffs, your local law enforcement, anyone you can possibly get hands of, friends, families, everybody. And not only that, read it yourself. Educate yourself on these issues. We've got a call with Sheriff Mack that we've been talking to about the powers of the sheriff. And we have Michael Bednarik's a regular columnist in all our issues. We've got some really good information on the subject. And right now, if you wait 6 months to act on this particular issue that we're talking about the Second Amendment stuff that's coming up right now, it might be too late. They might have already passed, or the stuff might be too far along in the legislation process for us to really put a stop to it. Of course, we can try to assert our rights by saying, no, we're not going to take it, but it's easier to cut off the head of the beast when it's smaller, when it's more manageable. We need to do this stuff right now. So I recommend whatever you can do, start conversations with people, get magazines, send people video links, whatever you can do, listen to radio programming. You have to get this information out to people, and I urge you, if you have anything, any call to action, you have any conscience at all, this, I believe, the Second Amendment was put in the Constitution for one reason, that is to protect our freedom of speech and the rights of the people over the governments when they become tyrannous. And if we lose this right, we've lost it all. That's my opinion, because this is our last line of defense. And unfortunately, it's under attack right now, and so is America. So, Michael, I want to thank you so much for coming on the call with us today. This webinar broadcast is going to be available here very shortly. You could probably come back to the webpage in a matter of minutes, and you'll be able to actually play the replay and send everyone else, you know, to this replay as well. But anyway, thank you so much for taking your time to come on and share some information and insights, you know, with our readers and listeners. And where can people go to get more information about you?
My website is constitutionpreservation.com. constitutionpreservation.org, constitutionpreservation.org. And my recommendation is that you go to the website, click the menu item for book, and download a free copy of Chapter 2 entitled Rights versus Privileges. Read Chapter 2 of the book. If you like the idea, forward that email email attachment to everybody on your mailing list. If 300 million people in the United States were to read and understand Chapter 2 of my book, a lot of these problems would start to go away. That's my contribution. I will continue to fight for liberty as long as I am capable of taking a breath. And as I said earlier, once I'm gone, liberty is not my problem. It's your problem. So it's up to you to defend it.
Well said. Thanks again, Mike. Now, everybody, just don't forget, you can go ahead and start marking your calendars. We've got Larry Pratt on later this week, which actually is tomorrow. We've got Edwin Vieira coming on Thursday. And we've got April Renee coming Friday. Same time. We're doing it at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. You can listen to the web event online for free live, or you can actually call in to our offices listed on the website. Same page, republicmagazine.com/webinar. And if everyone has a little homework assignment, I would say bring one person at least with you to listen to this information. And we'll get the scoop from Larry. Make sure that everyone gets a chance to listen to the recording we just did with Michael Bednarik, which will be available in 5 minutes on the same web page. Okay? Thanks a lot, everybody. And thanks, Michael. And we'll be seeing you soon.
Thank you.
The moderator has left the conference.